Good afternoon, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Alzheimer's disease is a progressive degenerative dementia. That means it causes progressive loss of intellectual function, including thinking, remembering, and reasoning. It is now the fourth leading cause of death in adults in the United States. Our phone numbers in Anchorage are 550-8422, and our toll-free number 1-800-478-8255. Our email address, line1@APRN.org. Coming up next hour, we'll be talking about Alzheimer's disease and what we know about prevention on Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by The Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's topic is Alzheimer's disease. Our phone numbers are familiar to you if you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422, and our toll-free number 1-800-478-8255. And you can email questions during our program at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at APRN.org. My guest today is Dr. Gary Small. He's professor of psychiatry and director of the UCLA Center for Aging. His research team has been working on developing brain technologies that detect the first signs of aging in the brain and also Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Small, it's a pleasure to have you join us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Before we get started, let me just remind our listeners, next week we're going to be talking about the healthcare reform, and we'll be talking with Dr. Dick Monsager, the CEO of Providence Alaska Medical Center, and Richard Neubauer, who happens to be the chair of the American College of Physicians chair on a committee on health and public policy. Dr. Small, let's start off by just kind of defining dementia and then working our way into Alzheimer's and what separates that. But there are other causes of dementia, I understand.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start, because often the public think of the term dementia, it's a little scary. I remember when I was a kid, we had Dr. Demento, who was a radio host, and it actually has a technical meaning. To a psychiatrist or neurologist, dementia might be defined as impairment in memory, impairment in at least one other cognitive area. It could be language, it could be personality, and that impairment has to interfere with everyday function. I mean, all of us get forgetful once in a while, but we're able to take care of our lives. And a demented person can't do that. They need help from others. So if you have dementia, there are a lot of different causes. And the most common cause is Alzheimer's disease. And that's defined as a dementia that is gradual in its onset, gradual in its progression. And you find when the person passes away and you look in their brain, you see abnormally high concentrations of insoluble proteins called amyloid plaques and tau tangles. And these abnormalities or lesions are in areas of the brain that control memory and cognition. So that's the short definition. Mm-hmm. We can probably talk more than an hour or weeks and weeks about more of the details.
Since I was an epidemiologist by training, I also like to get to the point of like who gets it, when do they get it, where do they get it? Does it give us any hints about associated factors?
We're all susceptible, but the greatest risk factor is age. So about 5 to 10% of people 65 or older get Alzheimer's disease. But when you get to age 85, the numbers go way up, maybe 40%. In one study, they found 50% of people. So every few years, the older you are, the higher is your risk. And other risk factors can be family history. So genetics are important, but they're not the whole story, which is why a lot of what I describe to people in my popular books and in my lectures, is that we have more control than we think. That non-genetic factors, lifestyle choices, healthy lifestyle, can be very important in keeping the brain healthy for many years. You can't change who your parents are, but you can change what you decide to eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and how much you exercise every day.
How about where people get this? We think about it as the U.S. is, and we always are concentrating on ourselves. But what about the rest of the world, and what about developed and undeveloped nations? Is there any significant differences there?
Well, it's all over the world, so there are millions of people affected worldwide. In the U.S., the estimate is about 5 million, maybe worldwide, anywhere 25, 50 million, depends on what study you're looking at. And there are some differences that have been cited in a few studies between countries. For example, Hugh Hendry, who is a professor of psychiatry at Indiana University, did a study comparing rates of dementia in African Americans in Indianapolis to those in, I believe it was Nigeria, Africans in Nigeria. And he found that, well, let me ask you, where do you think the rate would be higher, in the U.S. or in Africa?
U.S.
Yeah, you're right. And they thought one of the reasons was lifestyle.
Right.
Was that in Africa there's a simpler diet, there's less fast foods, people are, you know, working hard in the fields. And in the U.S., we're all, I guess you hear the term glutton for punishment. We're a glutton for the fast foods.
Right.
And that's not good for in terms of risk of diabetes, being overweight, lots of illnesses that are associated with age-related health problems, not only diabetes, but hypertension and high cholesterol. And there's comorbidity, certainly, with Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, it wasn't such a lucky guess on my part. I mean, so much of what we're looking at now in the U.S. with chronic disease seems to be uniquely Western or developed nations, and so there's a lot of work going in at looking at lifestyle and arthritis and asthma and allergies and many chronic diseases.
But, you know, we get clues when we look at the epidemiology and we look at cross-national differences or cross-cultural differences. And an interesting lead that we're following up on in our research here at UCLA is a much lower rate of Alzheimer's disease in India. And certainly there's a lot of differences between our cultures, but one very big one is diet. And Indians eat a lot of curried foods. Turns out that curcumin, which goes into curry spice, our scientists have found that curcumin is a potent anti-inflammatory. It also has an effect on these abnormal amyloid protein deposits. And so we're beginning some studies to look at whether curcumin might be able to stave off Alzheimer's disease.
Hmm. Hmm. Before, I know your research is in some of this early detection, and before I get to that, I'd like to maybe ferret out a little bit more about this particular disease. And the pathology is interesting. These tangles and plaques, are they unique to Alzheimer's, or are they unique to all dementias, or can you see them in people who otherwise we can't find anything suggesting even the earliest signs of dementia?
They are not unique. In fact, plaques and tangles build up in the brain in normal aging.
Okay.
And Brock and Brock were some famous neuropathologists who studied people who died of various causes at different ages from their 20s into their 90s, and they found that there's a very systematic buildup of these abnormal proteins in the brain. There are people who have high concentrations and don't seem to get dementia, so there's probably some other variables that are important, but for the most part, if you get up to a certain level in these memory centers of the brain, you will get Alzheimer's disease to a greater or lesser degree. Now, there are a group of dementias called frontal temporal dementias, and many of these are what we call tauopathies, meaning that they don't get amyloid plaques, but they only get tau. And there are some diseases that people only get amyloid plaques. And then there's overlap with situations, for example, head trauma. If you hit your head and you have some damage to your brain, there will be some plaque deposition. But there's other things that overlap. We know inflammation is an important part of developing diseases from cardiovascular disease to Alzheimer's disease. So, for example, with head trauma, initially there's going to be an inflammatory response, and then there'll be plaque deposition. So what helps us in distinguishing Alzheimer's from other causes of dementia can be the brain scanning technologies, PET or MRI, and also the pattern of the clinical symptoms can be very helpful.
So tell me if I'm wrong. So what I'm hearing is these markers that we have right now and are using most commonly, at least, and this is a postmortem thing, it seems like, unfortunately, is the plaques and the tangles. It's those are normal, but to where they happen, which cells may lead to a different kind of finding, and then it suggests also that there may be other factors leading to the buildup in the particular cells where they're being found.
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, you see these plaques and tangles in the brain in small concentrations. Mm-hmm. When they build up to a higher concentration, then you start to see problems. And in fact, today, you don't have to wait for autopsy to see them. At UCLA, we were the first to invent a chemical marker that we use with PET scanning, where you can see for the first time in history plaque and tangle buildup in living people. Now, there are other chemical markers that show the plaques, but ours is still the only one that shows both plaques and tangles. And I think there's tremendous excitement about that because we can begin to see the buildup of Alzheimer's disease years before people get obvious symptoms, which can be scary. Oh, my God, there's Alzheimer's in my brain, and I'm still in my 40s or 50s. I think it's cause for hope because it means to me that we can see a problem years before it occurs. So that allows us to hopefully find prevention treatment so we can protect a healthy brain rather than try to repair it once the damage sets in.
You know, in preparing for the program, I was looking around a little bit at some of the research, and there seems like there's a big effort at trying to find these early markers of suggesting that the disease process has initiated.
Huge effort right now, and takes up a lot of my time every day trying to work on these studies and to get other people to use them. So I think it's a very exciting time, and I'm excited to talk about it, what the prospect is for the future, and also to try to educate people on what we have now. Now, I know that this program broadcasts throughout Alaska, is that correct?
Not entirely at this time. We had a large portion of the population, though.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I'm excited that next week I'll actually be visiting Alaska thanks to the Alaska Alzheimer's Association. So I'll be in Juneau on Monday, November 2nd, and I pop into Anchorage on the 3rd, and then I'll be hitting Fairbanks as well on the 3rd. So if you contact your local Alzheimer's Association, they may tell you where my talks are going to be, and hopefully I can meet you and answer your questions, those listeners out there personally.
Yeah, for our listeners, you go to Alzheimer's Resource of Alaska. We have the link on our website. I unfortunately don't have a phone number right in front of me, but just go to Alzheimer's Resource of Alaska on your browser or go to our website, and you can have a link and find out where Dr. Small will be docking here in Anchorage November 3rd. Good. Thanks for bringing that up very much. I appreciate it. I know
my
Alzheimer's Association was instrumental in getting you to come up here and contacting me about interviewing with you.
Well, I've never been to Alaska. I'm excited about visiting, and I look forward to meeting all the folks up there.
You know, one of the questions that came in by email is an association. Is there any association that's been looked at that you're aware of with vitamin D? I'm not sure if you know this, but at least a lot of immunologic disorders seem to have a variability with higher latitudes. We see more of it. Vitamin D is particularly a problem in people who live in northern climates, particularly if you have darker skin, because that's our primary source of vitamin D. Any insight on vitamin D and Alzheimer's?
Well, there is some interesting work going on. There's no proof that taking high doses of vitamin D will prevent Alzheimer's disease. And I would caution people because even though it's great to have a vitamin D supplement if you need it, you should do it under your doctor's supervision. Vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin, which means if you take too much, it'll hang out in your body. Just because it's natural doesn't mean that it's necessarily safe. So, and there's no evidence that taking vitamin D in high doses is going to prevent or treat Alzheimer's disease. But having said that, there are some interesting studies showing associations between lower levels of vitamin D and poorer memory performance, but no proof as yet.
Okay. Let me remind our listeners, if you have questions, call us at 550-8422 if you're local. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, and you can reach us at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at APRN.org over until about 3 o'clock Anchorage time if you have questions you want to transmit that way. What about early detection with testing? Some of the evidence, I guess some of the reasons for having some of these early markers is that may then we could correlate with just simple tests that we might do of reasoning and spatial abilities and so forth. Is that going anywhere?
Well, there's a lot of work in that area that, you know, there's a condition called mild cognitive impairment, which is in a way is a risk factor for getting Alzheimer's. And that's when people start having memory difficulties, but they're still pretty much functionally independent. They can take care of themselves. But with neuropsychological testing, we can put somebody in that group and we can watch them more carefully. We can start testing medications at that point before the problem is so severe. And in our site, we actually test people who are even milder, just have what I have when I walk into a room and I'm distracted and I can't remember why did I come here in here. Almost everybody complains about age-related memory changes, and we usually joke about it, but it is possible that we could use treatments to even help people with that. So I think with the pencil and paper test, that's important, but I think we're also very keen on developing some kind of a blood test or a brain scan that really gives us information that will allow us to treat these milder problems before they become worse. I see it in the future that we'll have something like a cholesterol test for the brain. If you have high cholesterol, you take a drug to lower your future risk for a stroke or heart attack. I am hopeful that we'll have a brain scan or a blood test or both that will tell us, my goodness, your plaque and tangle count is too high. Let's put you on, you know, miracle drug A so that you are less likely to get Alzheimer's, or you'll get it when you reach 110 rather than 85.
We're going to take a break shortly, but before we do that, I'd also like one more time to go through, because so many people, I'm 61, are thinking, golly, what about my memory's not like it was? What's the early signs? Paint me a mental image of the way this gets started and what's different between that and some of the normal memory issues that people are worried about that really may not have any association with this illness.
Well, I think this is a big question, and it stumps families and doctors all the time. So what you see is normal age-related memory loss is quite similar to the early signs of Alzheimer's. So it's a slippery mm-hmm. slope.
Okay.
And certainly if you have a family history, you're going to be more concerned about it. You're going to be more anxious. So it's a question of age, severity of these symptoms. Are they interfering with your life? Do you have risk factors, family history of Alzheimer's, older age, other illnesses like diabetes or hypertension that could be or Parkinson's that could be associated with a cognitive problem? Have you ruled out with your doctor the possibility that it's a medication side effect, very common problem? Or do you have depression, which can look like Alzheimer's disease? So I think it can be quite complex, and it's hard for people to decide on their own. It's really something they need to check with their doctor on. I see very often there's tremendous stigma and people don't go to the doctor and they wait too long. And it's very sad. They don't get the help that's out there. There are symptomatic drugs that treat the illness. They don't cure it, but they certainly improve quality of life. And I encourage people, if they're concerned, talk with their doctor. I've written several popular books to help people with these issues, the Memory Bible, the Longevity Bible, my new book, iBrain. And people, what I often say is look at the Memory Bible, try some of the memory techniques, try the lifestyle approach. If you get better, chances are you don't have a serious problem. But when in doubt, check with your doctor, because the studies show that the earlier you get treatment, the better off you are.
You know, the difficulty at finding an early marker also goes a long way to explaining why there may be a long prodrome or a long period before accurate diagnosis is really made, which is, again, getting back to your rationale for trying to find the early definite diagnostic.
Yeah.
And that then, of course, leads to difficulty in maybe beginning to address the problem. Well, we have another call or email suggested or asked the question about the association between herpes viruses and this. And there was a – I don't know if this is old information. The information she sent suggested that there had been a lot of research, and it kind of suggested to me that this is a very common disorder and also herpes infections. Most of us in the United States have had some infection. Do you have any knowledge about association with particularly herpes virus type 1?
Well, you know, I think you point to the challenge here in terms of herpes, and certainly, you know, any kind of illness like Alzheimer's, we're all going to explore possibilities. I mean, could some kind of an infection predispose people? And there is some work in the literature looking at that. You know, another one is chlamydia, and thought that maybe that was a problem. In fact, I was involved in a study looking in pathology samples of brain tissue. Was there a higher concentration of chlamydial virus? Mm-hmm. So I think there's nothing definite on that, and it is a common problem, and we're still trying to understand it.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're speaking with Dr. Gary Small, professor of psychiatry and director of the UCLA Center on Aging and doing research into the early diagnostic efforts at finding Alzheimer's. So you can email your questions and comments to line1@aprn.org, or you can call us at 550-8422. Outside Anchorage is 1-800-478-8255. For Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, providing Alaska women complete breast imaging services since 1986, including radiologists who specialize in breast imaging 5 days a week. Information online at provimaging.com. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Gary Small. He's professor of psychiatry and director of the UCLA Center on Aging. He's joining us from Los Angeles. If you have questions or comments, a couple of ways to get those to us. You can email at line1@aprn.org. You can call us directly at 550-8422 if you're in town. And those of you outside of Anchorage, you need a toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And please remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. Another listener has emailed in and wants to know what's the source of the amyloid proteins that form the plaques? Or do they seem to derive from certain foods, or what's really the reason that what's in these?
Well, that's plaques. The billion-dollar question, actually. And we know that the amyloid protein is a very short, small protein, and it's cleaved off from a much larger protein that is embedded in the cell membrane. The issue is where it's cleaved off, and if it's cleaved off at an abnormal point, that's where it becomes a problem, because instead of remaining soluble, it becomes fibrillar and becomes insoluble. Now, there's a lot of controversy and discussion about what's really going on. Is it the precursor before it becomes fibrillar that is toxic, or is it the actual plaque itself? We don't know for sure, and there's a lot of work on it. So that's, you know, at one level an issue. Another is that there have been some rare genetic mutations in this larger protein, the amyloid precursor protein, and that genetic mutation causes the disease. But that's quite rare, and it doesn't explain how do you get to the tangles, too, because you need plaques and tangles to get the disease. It's not one or the other. So I think that, this question tells you that we know some things, but we don't know it all, and we have more to work on.
So this just shows how much fun science can be. I mean, you're putting together a very interesting mystery, and we're beginning to see some abnormalities, and you can easily, your mind can jump to things like, oh, there's a genetic risk with whatever the enzyme is that has to do with cleaving of this amyloid protein, or is there other environmental factors that affect this? And then that may not even be where things are going, but it can be extremely difficult to figure these things out.
Yes.
Not too long ago, I remember reading some information about this loss of sense of smell having a relationship to Alzheimer's. I haven't heard so much about that recently.
Well, that's another point. I mean, people are looking at all types of simple biological tests. And actually, a friend and colleague of mine at Columbia University, Dev Devanon, has been quite interested in this. And what they're finding is that if you give an Alzheimer victim a sniff test, so to speak, you find that they're not as good at recognizing the odors, the different smells that someone who's normal would how they would respond. So that's intriguing, and it's interesting to me that the olfactory area of the brain, the part of the brain that controls the sense of smell, is very close to the hippocampus, one of the key memory centers.
So it's as if the findings, for example, do they find these plaques and tau's in the olfactory center? Do you know if that's correlated?
I believe they do. Uh-huh. They may very well.
Uh-huh. There's also been, before, I really want to ask you about your research and what's important, but I know there's also been, every time I pick up a magazine almost, I see a new 10 or 15 question test on Alzheimer's disease. Should we be careful about those, or is that also something that has some validity?
You know, I think that there can be some validity in these different tests, but I think people don't want to, I think it's important not to overinterpret them because, it's not 100%. It's something that you can see how I'm hemming and hawing.
Sure.
With a lot of these questions, because it's not simple, answer.
Right, right. Well, tell us a little bit about your research, maybe focusing on what you think are some of the more promising areas, and also how did you get to where you are? I think it's very important for listeners to hear how science kind of works and progresses along a line.
Well, my research is focusing on early detection and prevention of this problem. So I got there because I just think the principle of trying to refurbish or repair damaged neurons is going to be a tremendous challenge and probably more difficult than protecting those neurons.
Mm-hmm.
So in that pursuit, I've been working very hard on developing technologies to peer into the brain to try to identify the first inkling of a problem. And to do that, I've developed a multidisciplinary program that includes chemists and mathematicians and psychologists and neurologists. And together, we've come up with some very interesting novel approaches. I think you've got to think outside the box to solve these problems. And probably one of the best things that we've done is get an interdisciplinary group together and think in an innovative way how to approach it, and I think that's helped us a lot. So we've invented several small molecules that seem to be able to track the disease, detect it years earlier than it's present. We've developed a brain stress test, so to speak, similar to a cardiac treadmill stress test that has a similar approach, and we're keen on trying to help people not just with medications that we're trying to develop or supplements, but also lifestyle. Probably the best thing we all could do is get about 10-20 minutes of cardiovascular conditioning each day, which would not only extend our life expectancy by a few years, but also lower our risk for Alzheimer's, diabetes, and a number of other age-related illnesses. So, you know, we have this information, but the next problem is, how do you get people to change their lifestyle? Because most people come to me and they say, you know, that's fine, doc, but can you give me a pill, make it easy for me? So we've been trying to be creative in terms of our lifestyle approaches, and we've been relatively successful. One of our programs, a memory training program based on my book, The Memory Bible, is now available in 7 states throughout the U.S. Maybe one thing we can do is get it licensed up in Alaska and get people to start taking this wonderful course where they sit together in groups of about a dozen or two dozen and learn memory techniques and lifestyle approach to improve their daily lives.
So that raises the question, if exercise is beneficial, physical exercise, are you suggesting that mental exercise, continuing to use our brains as we age, is also, I'm going to use the word protective, you tell me if that's too strong of a word.
Well, I think that, you know, there is some soft evidence of use it or lose it when it comes to brain exercise. People who do crossword puzzles or read or play board games have a better ability to do those games, obviously, and it's associated with a lower risk for Alzheimer's. But cause and effect has not been proven as yet. So, you know, I think we need to have more evidence before we can say it's definitely the proof. I don't want people to think, well, I got, gee, doc, I did those crossword puzzles, and look, I got Alzheimer's anyway. And the same thing with physical exercise or healthy brain diet. But I think, you know, regardless of what your level of cognitive ability is, I'm always reviewing it with my patients, whether they're very mild or they're more severe, and we go over their lifestyle to try to make their lives better.
You know, it seemed like if exercise, and again, I'm one that would think and hope that exercise is an important one, that it would be fairly easy, I would think, to look at dementias with a large group of people now doing exercise like marathons and so forth well into their 70s and even 80s, I read about, that they should have a significantly less percentage of them developing dementias. Has that been done that you're aware of?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of work in this area where there's definitely this association between physical exercise and lower risk for dementia. But there are groups, our group, we're trying to develop this. I have a young scientist who's quite interested in it. They've done a lot of work at the University of Illinois. Arthur Kramer has done some excellent work showing that if you put people on a cardiovascular conditioning program, it has definite effects on brain function and structure and on cognitive ability.
We have a caller. Looks like she's got a question related to some foods and diet. Doris, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes. I heard a little bit about what you said, and I can hear the radio a little bit better now. I would like to know, you know, because the doctor says Alzheimer's increases with age, and aging people have a tendency, the body as it ages has a tendency not to function as well as when it was younger. And you see a lot of older people that get thinner and thinner as they get older. So I'm just assuming that they do not really assimilate their food, you know, water or air as well as younger people do. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I think there certainly are a lot of age-related issues that come into play. And, you know, it is true that older people do not absorb all the nutrients that they should. That's why, in terms of supplements, I always recommend a multivitamin that makes sense. So, yes, there are age-related differences that are important. It also comes into play when we think about medication, that older people have more trouble tolerating medications. They're more sensitive to side effects. So we have to be very careful about age-related effects there.
Why is that?
Well, you know, the body changes. Our body our brain receptors become more sensitive to the medications. There's more atrophy or shrinkage. So it just happens. You know, you probably notice yours. I've noticed myself. I tend to be a little more sensitive to medications as I get older and develop side effects that I didn't have earlier in life.
Well, like your liver, your gallbladder, and pancreas and things help you to take care of things that come into the system. And and if those things could be improved, would that prevent anything like Alzheimer's or other things?
Well, certainly, if your body's healthy, it's only going to help. And also, if there are physical illnesses that a person is experiencing, that can affect memory and cognition in a negative way. So we want to keep people as healthy as possible in trying to help them with these kinds of issues.
Yeah, and then, if somebody has chronic diseases that you know, that they maybe have them all the time to a certain extent, you know, that would they would be more susceptible to something like Alzheimer's?
Depends on the chronic disease. If it's diabetes, it increases their risk. If it's hypertension, they definitely have a risk. Because, you know, hypertension does not help the brain. It can cause small strokes, and that could worsen whatever symptoms there are of Alzheimer's disease.
Okay. Well, then, if you're a certain blood type, does that affect Alzheimer's?
As far as I know, that doesn't affect it.
It doesn't. Well, if you have a stroke, there's two different kinds of strokes, you know. Is one worse with Alzheimer's than others?
Well, it can be, depending on what part of the brain is damaged, right? So if a memory center is affected, that's going to make it worse. If it's a motor physical center, it may not affect the disease as much.
I know you said something about exercise before, but I have heard in the past, too, that people that walk a lot, older people that walk a lot, can improve their brain as far as mental problems and strokes and things like that goes. And I was wondering if that would affect Alzheimer's.
Well, certainly physical exercise is great. Even if you have Alzheimer's, that's probably a good thing to do. So when you exercise your body, it not only helps your heart health, but it can help your brain health. It can improve blood flow to the brain. There are just many terrific effects on the brain as a result of physical exercise. So I'm always encouraging people to exercise.
Doris, there's a couple of good websites on our website at Line 1. I'll refer you to those, and you can look at some of those.
I don't have such a thing, and I can't get there because I have no transportation. I want to ask you one more thing.
All righty, one more.
I met a man that, his wife anyhow, because he had Alzheimer's disease, that worked in a factory that made aluminum. And I've heard about other people also that were working in aluminum or ingested them somehow or other, that could have caused, could have been one of the causes of Alzheimer's, and he did have Alzheimer's.
Yeah, there have been some studies looking at aluminum as a possibility. It's never been proven. We don't know, is aluminum going to the brain damage areas, or is aluminum causing the brain damage? So it's an issue of the cart, you know, before the horse.
Because I understand aluminum is very difficult to get out of your body.
Mm-hmm. Well, heavy metals are an issue. I mean, we know fish has omega-3 fats, which is good for the brain. but some fish...
How about mercury?
Well, that's what I was going to say. Some fish have a lot of mercury. So, you know, what I often recommend is a balance in our lives, not to overdo things and try to be reasonable.
Doris, I need to move on for the other other calls. I appreciate your call.
Thank you, Doris. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You bet. I think it probably bears discussing, and we try to talk about this a number of times. It's easy to sow association between things, but you really have to look at what's the risk when you are around, let's say, aluminum or mercury, and then what percentage
right.
of people don't have it
Absolutely.
Who are around it. So, you know, these associations are easy. Proving causality is a whole different ball of wax.
Whole other thing, yeah.
How about you? I'm interested and somewhat intrigued about the markers. So what you're doing is you develop some markers that I assume attach to these plaques or amyloid or something in some way where you might see them forming earlier.
Right.
Is that what happens?
Right. I mean, basically, they temporarily bind to the plaques and tangles in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And that way we can see whether there's a big signal or a little signal.
And you follow them over time to see what percentage of people go ahead and develop more obvious symptoms?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And then, again, that it somehow suggests then that the whatever is causing these plaques or the buildup of these plaques are clearly associated with the illness. I guess I'm still concerned that maybe somehow these are just confounding variables again, maybe somehow unrelated.
The plaques themselves?
Yeah, but it seems like they're pretty well related, it seems like.
I mean, they're very much correlated with the disease, but there is still some debate over, you know, and even there are the Taoists, the people who believe in Tao, and then the Baptists, the people who believe in beta amyloid. So there's a lot of debate there. You know, is this a cause or effect? So that we do know that they're helpful in tracking the disease, but you know, there's been some disappointment recently in terms of the amyloid because the drug trials have not been as positive as people would have liked. So, you know, we're trying to explore all these possibilities.
I remind our listeners once again, if you want to contact us by telephone and ask a question until just before 3 o'clock local time, 550-8422 is our local number. Toll free 1-800-478-8255 and line 1 at aprn.org is our email address. I'll remind everybody again, Dr. Small will be up in Juneau. When did you say? November 2nd? And then
are you testing my memory right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, and then the 3rd here in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and you can
so
go to our...
I think I've got a memory device here called a computer that makes me very smart. As I see it here, I'm going to be in Juneau on November 2nd, and I will be in Anchorage November 3rd, I believe, around noon, and then... Fairbanks around noon on November 3rd, and then the evening in Anchorage on November 3rd.
All right, and for those of you who want to know more information, look up Alzheimer's Resource of Alaska on your browser, or you can go to our website, and there's a link directly to their website, and I'm sure you can call them from that website, or you may even have the specifics there. Well, let's talk a little bit more about treatment then. How do these treatments work? Are they directed against these proteins? How successful are they? How are we doing?
Well, in fact, the treatments that we have, the medical treatments, are not directed against these proteins. They're directed mm-hmm. against another problem that we see with Alzheimer's, and that's a deficit in cholinergic neurons. Now, this is a family of brain cells that produce a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. And with Alzheimer's disease, there's a deficiency. And so these drugs boost those cholinergic activities in the brain and improve memory and cognition and behavior and help people temporarily, maybe a year or two or even longer. There's another drug, another class of drug that affects another neurotransmitter system, and you can take more than one drug. So you can take, say, Exelon or Aricept, which are cholinergic drugs, and you can add Namenda to that. You take both to get even better effect. The anti-amyloid or anti-tau drugs are still being tested, so we don't have anything that's available currently in that area.
So these drugs that are available now really, in a sense, are continuing to help symptoms. They're not really, as far as we can tell, changing the natural process of this disease.
Right.
And that's what we're still looking for, is if we can understand what's happening, then we can begin to interfere with that mechanism.
Yeah, we want, or, you know, just at least to find other areas of the brain that are affected to have an impact.
Mm-hmm. There's, when you read about Alzheimer's, you can't help but get the sense from a lot of the writing that that we're on the verge of a rather large epidemic because of the aging population and the very high percentage of individuals who reach these older ages that develop dementias and Alzheimer. Is that overdone, or is that a real cause for concern?
Well, I think that, you know, there is cause for concern. We're, you know, we're getting old, we're living longer, but not necessarily better. And I think that's the rub that we're trying to deal with. And, you know, it takes some thoughtfulness, take some creativity to try to deal with these issues. But we have some very, very bright people involved, and I'm confident that we're going to get somewhere, that in the next 5 to 10 years we're going to have some hit some major milestones and really have an impact on this devastating illness.
If someone thinks that someone they know closely or a relative or a loved one is developing symptoms of Alzheimer's, what's the next thing? What's the most important thing you think they should be doing at this point?
Well, I think the first thing is to see a doctor and
uh-huh.
find out what's really going on.
Uh-huh.
So that's number one. You know, I think that also not to give up hope, to know that there are people out there that can help, that there are approaches, and to not do it alone, which is tremendously important. Really get help from others.
The neurologists are primarily the physicians who are most skilled in understanding this disorder, making the diagnosis, and beginning to offer the best treatments?
Well, being a psychiatrist, I would strongly disagree with you.
Okay.
Right. Actually, you know, some of my best friends are neurologists. So, you know, I think it's really, you know, it's interesting because you have some wonderful neurologists, some wonderful geriatric psychiatrists, some wonderful mm-hmm. geriatric internists or even
right.
general internists and family physicians that are
right.
very involved and very helpful
mm-hmm.
with the illness. So to me, it's really more the individual.
Right.
It could even be a nurse practitioner
right.
who can be very helpful.
So you're looking for somebody who has a lot of experience and interest.
Who's comfortable with it and who you as a family and a patient are comfortable with.
We only have a few minutes left. I've got, let's take this. I got one, another phone call. I was going to have you sum up the most important, but let's go ahead and take Todd's call. Todd, you're on line one.
Yes. My question has two parts. Number one, I'm just wondering, and I don't know if this has been addressed earlier in the program. I just tuned in a little while ago. But I'm wondering if, you know, the talk of plaques, you know, and the association in the brain material with Alzheimer's has any connection to the accumulation of fats or plaques in any other parts of the body. Not to mean that an obese person would be more prone or anything like that, but, you know, the possibility of other connections to other discoveries of plaques and fats in the body in different places, maybe the liver, maybe the bloodstream, maybe wherever.
So,
and then the second part
Before you get to that and ask a second
yeah.
question, and you test
okay.
my short-term memory, let me try that one. It's a different kind of plaque. It's not the same kind of plaque you get that the dentist cleans from your teeth. It's not the same one that causes heart disease. So it really is not related.
Okay, so there's been, no matchup. The other thing is touching on that question a little bit, and then the question the other lady had, you know, and asking about the heavy metals and exposures. What I'm wondering is how far has the medical community come with Alzheimer's, but also other diseases and trying to discover their paths in terms of bonding up the arts of pathology and logistics to create med mapping, and how open is the public right now, and how open is the medical community to really developing that stuff, at least statistically? You know, we don't even have have to include anybody's name, but
yeah, epidemiology is probably one of the earliest medical sciences, which has looked between associations between where things happen, what is associated with it, and so forth. It is a huge, huge area with lots of research. It's right. Nothing new.
Would we have exponential growth if we were to start actually, you know, taking all of this medical information and having the Centers for Disease Control really go over this stuff?
That's what they do.
It is. Okay.
It's already what they're doing. Yeah, they have a whole thing on heavy metals. They have things on all chronic diseases. They're constantly doing that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet. Mm-hmm. You bet. We've only got about, a minute here. I want you to please sum up what you think is most important for us to remember about our talk today.
Well, I think, number one, Alzheimer's is a common problem. Number two, it can be tricky to diagnose, but we can do it. Most physicians who are well-trained know how to diagnose this, and there are treatments out there. So if you are concerned, go see your doctor. Find out about what's causing your problems and do something now rather than later. The sooner you get to it, the sooner you're going to benefit.
Dr. Small, thanks very much for taking the time with us, and good luck on your trip up here, and I hope you have good turnout for your discussion.
Thank you for your discussion.
All right. Have a good day.
All right. Bye.
Line 1's going to return next week, as you all might expect, and we'll be talking with Dr. Dick Monsager. He is CEO of Providence Alaska Medical Center, and also Dr. Richard Neubauer. He's Chief of Service for Internal Medicine at the Alaska Native Medical Center, but also Chair of the Health and Public Policy Committee of the American College of Physicians. Our topic will be healthcare reform. We'll be looking at it particularly from the physician's perspective. Pat Yak is Vice President of 8PTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, your health connection, is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network and by the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescription, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Stroke is an emergency. Providence Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.